This is Side Hustle with Luke and Omar. We'll explore what it takes to run a side hustle with talented individuals from different backgrounds and experiences. We will discuss things like taking the plunge, personal challenges, and the balancing act of maintaining a day job whilst side hustling to make the dream a reality. Now sit back, relax, as we talk to some of these amazing individuals. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. We understand it's a Friday evening and you've just had a long drive from,
Great Ocean Road.
Great Ocean Road. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, so we're really grateful that you're here. Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's the pleasure is all ours. Obviously, this is Side Hustle. You're here. Luke, what's going on? What's your week?
It's been a big week. And I was saying to Omar before, actually, my daughter last night, she pooed herself for like
12:30. How old's your daughter?
Two.
Okay.
So it was just horrible. It was horrible. And then she didn't go back to sleep till 4:20. So I haven't had that much sleep last night.
Yep. But
feeling pretty good.
Cool. Thanks for being here.
Besides,
man.
My bags, I don't know.
Joe, we wanted to kind of start this by you giving us a brief intro just about yourself, background, and what your side hustle kind of consists of, and then we'll just kind of keep rolling with the conversation.
Okay, sure. So my background is I started out in psychology. So I did 6 years at ANU, and then I got into a PhD and decided not to do that. So I now went and worked in Europe in sort of art, fashion, furniture.
Sorry, did you complete your PhD?
No, I got in to do a PhD.
Okay.
And I was over in London, so my boyfriend at the time got into doing a Masters of Law at Oxford.
You guys are smart.
Well, my boyfriend is very smart, but yeah, and well, my ex-boyfriend, I should say. And yeah, so we went to Europe just for the year. Mm-hmm. And my mum, I was sort of really confused because I'd sort of really hated postgraduate research, but I'd done quite well, but I just had hated the whole process.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like completely opposite to my personality type, which is quite extroverted and is just like a lot of attention to detail and being by yourself, and that I'm sort of more of a big picture person,
so sure.
I just couldn't understand how you could just study this really tiny topic for like years,
for your entire life.
Yeah exactly. And I was like sort of going, how am I going to do this? And I went to ANU and everyone that I knew was a lawyer or going into working for like an NGO or politician or something like that.
Sorry, what's ANU?
Australian National University.
Okay. Sorry, I'm not from here, so
okay,
forgive
right. Yeah.
Yep.
And so just everyone was very sort of academic, sort of diplomats, lawyers, all of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And I'd done sort of, 6.5 years of study, and my mum sort of said to me, well, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, but I've just done this degree and, I need to sort of get a proper job and all this kind of stuff or do something. And she said, okay, well, what would you be doing if you didn't have to, like if money wasn't a concern, it didn't matter how far down a road you'd gone and no one cared what you did. And I said, I'm working in fashion. And she's like, well, just go do that. So
as simple as that.
Yeah, as simple as that.
So you went from potentially doing a PhD to pivoting and doing something in fashion.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So, and I actually ended up moving to Denmark. I just fell in love with it when I went traveling, and then I ended up working there for a really long time. And then I moved back to Australia and I moved to Sydney and had a very sort of stark realization that the industry was very different here, particularly for fashion.
Fashion industry.
And so I was freelancing, and I came down to Melbourne for work, and I just loved it down here. And so I moved down here and had quite a few friends that were in various creative industries, and I was just freelancing.
What were you freelancing?
Sort of marketing, PR stuff. So when I was in Sydney, I was working for a couple of lifestyle brands and fashion brands. I don't know if you guys know Edition Studio.
Yep.
Yeah. So I was their global marketing and sales, but in a freelance role.
Sure.
And I quickly realized that most of the sort of brands that I would work for in Australia that were great were sort of like a one or two man show with mostly freelancers. And
Definitely.
I was like, wow, this is so different, and so I was just freelancing. And then I really wanted to move to Melbourne. I was sort of just like, I need to be down there. It seems way more like me in terms of just like even just the aesthetic of what people were wearing. And like I hadn't felt inspired from a fashion clothing perspective
since
I moved home. Yeah, I just started wearing like shorts and a t-shirt, and I was like, this is crazy, because I'm quite a colourful kind of dresser.
I
kind
know what
of
you mean.
Love patterns and sort of, and I in Copenhagen I would wear my sort of like silk pyjamas with like a pair of heels, and I just felt like that would never fly in Sydney.
You can't express yourself that way in Sydney.
No. Then I came down to Melbourne and, you know, you just walk down Brunswick Street and you're like, oh, this is awesome. So I was obsessed with moving down. And a friend of mine who's now part of the collective that's my side hustle, she was working in fashion, but she said to me, her sister's boyfriend is part of a motorcycle commune. I don't know if you know Custom Commune.
No.
Nah. It's a motorcycle commune here in Melbourne, and her boyfriend's part of it. And she said one of the other members said, I'm looking for a PR girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, I know a PR girl. She really wants to move to Melbourne. I said, great, I've got a 3-month-long contract. It's doing PR for Prince Edward, which is Charles's younger brother.
Yeah, wow.
When he comes to Australia.
Wow.
And so Ella called me and said, do you reckon you could do PR for a royal? And I was like, well, yeah, maybe. And she said, oh, I'm going to put you in touch. And I had no idea what the company was for. And it's actually for a youth development company called Duke of Ed.
Okay.
Duke of Edinburgh's International Award.
Yep.
And so their patron's Prince Edward.
Sure.
So
okay.
He came out for like a month and I did the PR for his trip out here.
Awesome.
And then
what did that PR entail?
Just like getting press to write about his visit. So he's the patron of this charity or this development program.
Okay.
And as the patron, you engage in like a whole lot of sort of different events. So Gold Award ceremony where the young people get recognized.
Okay. Pretty much just kind of building the hype about his visit and
it's really narrative building because like they're going to come and cover a royal, but it's sort of like more about like why, and it's a really great opportunity then to talk about like what the award does, and there's a huge focus on disadvantaged, marginalized children, all of that kind of stuff. So it's really just that. And then
so from your point of view, sorry, just to kind of answer, from your point of view, do you write any of the content as well? Like what's your role, I guess, in that?
It really depends. So when I was working in Europe, it was a very large company. So I was head of marketing and comms. So I had a big team underneath me, and I had not only a comms manager, but also we had a big PR company. So we used Starworks, which is a big international PR company. So in those cases, we would do a bit of writing, but it was more about like managing people and managing the narrative and figuring out what the strategy is.
Mm-hmm.
When I would work for a smaller company like Duke of Ed, even though it's a large international charity, in Australia, it's not that big.
Mm-hmm.
I would write all the content and then
awesome.
Engage with all the press as well. And I sort of didn't have any network in Australia at that point for that type of press. It was like all newspapers and, it's totally different than what I'm not like going to call like Hypebeast or Vice and say like, do you want to write about Prince Edward? Luckily I had a friend who worked at The Age, and she was a political writer. And so she was like, yeah, great. Like, well, you know, and she used to work at The Australian. So that was really helpful. And
yeah, cool.
I think you just think on your feet, and all the press were kind of interested in that, like interested to cover it. So it's just making sure that you write the right narrative. So the strategy part, you know, I had that experience, so that was
awesome. So does that work for like the whole lead up to the visit to the leaving?
Exactly. So that's why I was engaged with them for 3 months, pretty much full time, was because there's a whole lot of work to be done beforehand. And there's actually just a whole lot of bureaucracy involved. So when you run an event with a royal person, there's just so much involved beforehand. So I'm not sure how much I'm actually allowed to talk about it, but I'm just thinking from like, but like essentially you have to, he will know before he goes to an event, every single person's bio that he's going to talk to.
Oh, wow.
And you arrange the room so that they're in groups, and there's sort of like a lead person in each group that he'll know the bio of, and that's the person that gets introduced to him. And so what happens it's like, there'll be the person who hosts him. So in this case, it was our CEO. He'll take him and his private secretary around. The private secretary will move on, you know, 2 minutes before the prince comes over and talk to the sort of head group person, the leader of that group, and sort of get ready. And then the private secretary will do the introductions to the prince, between the prince and that person, whilst the other person who's the host just finishes up the conversation with the other. So it's all very planned out. And so in order for...
very proper.
And how long are those interactions? Like how long is each group?
3 minutes maybe. But depends on what he's interested in.
But the planning for that will probably be like days.
Oh, it's like
who's months. Getting to know who, their bios, how the people in the room know each other that he's about to meet.
Yeah, like, it's very coordinated, and it's like there's just a lot, you know. But it's also really impressive. Like I was always kind of like royals, whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But
did you get to meet him?
Yeah,
yourself?
I met him, and he's lovely. Like,
does he act pretty royal?
No, and my impression is that he's kind of, you know, the only sort of, well, not the only one, but he's one of the of the more sort of, he's very dedicated, you know, sure. And not that the others aren't dedicated, but he's just very calm. Okay. Like he's still married. Okay. His children don't have prince and princess titles.
Sure.
He stays out of the media belt. Okay. And he's very dedicated to the awards. So he does a lot, and it's super impressive, like to be knowing all those people, like just, he just wakes up in the morning. I was exhausted after 3 months. I was like, I need like at least like a month off, and then he just gets on that plane and goes to the next engagement.
Yeah,
and you
wow,
sort of
yeah,
think, okay. Wow, that's insane, you know. So he's starting his day at like before 6 a.m. learning all this stuff, then is on the road the whole entire time. And he's really passionate about it, so that's nice.
Yeah, wow. So when he met you, did he have your bio or did he go off the cuff?
Well, it's not that relevant for him to make an impression on me from like a professional standpoint.
Yeah.
So no, but he's very lovely. Like he came back again in September this year, but it was mm-hmm. up in Sydney. So I had less to do. The Sydney team takes care of that. So I had less to do with that. But he will say hello and nice to see you again. And he's like takes the job seriously, which is awesome. Really nice. Yeah. I had a funny, we stayed in the same hotel in Ballarat. So mm-hmm. there's a sort of hotel with like a royal kind of history. So I think it's called like the Royal Hotel in Ballarat.
And was it next to Sovereign Hill?
It's not next to Sovereign Hill. It's okay. Right in the centre of okay. Ballarat. And yep. it's where they used to, because of the gold rush,
yep.
the royals would come out. And there's this like hilarious beds where you have like a little stool to like step up into it. It's like a canopy bed, you know? And what happens at these dinners is you can't leave until the prince leaves, because that's protocol.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And it was the last night of the tour and I was just deadbeat exhausted.
But you can still excuse yourself if you need to use the men's room.
Oh, yeah,
or women's
of course.
Room
you
or whatever.
Just, so, you know, I mean, you can't leave. So. And then protocol, I mean, obviously, if you were ill, and I actually genuinely don't think anyone would notice if you left, but protocol right. states that you don't leave until the prince leaves.
Yeah, wow.
But he has an early bedtime.
Is there security reasons as well, or just kind of out of respect?
I think it's etiquette.
Okay.
So, but he doesn't stay late. He doesn't really drink very much. So, okay. You know, he sort of was hosting this dinner, and then sort of about 10 o'clock, he left, and I was like, yes. I can go to bed. It's like the last night.
Yeah.
And I made really good friends with the POs. So his private protection officers.
Yeah,
well. Yeah.
Because they're the ones I end up talking to a lot, because as media, they'll come up to maybe like that media, there's also etiquette things like where he'll be talking, say he'll be interacting with the young person. He did a lot of real tennis, which is this funny royal tennis game.
Okay.
And we have a lot of courts here in Australia. So he was playing, and that's a great chance for him to kind of interact with the kids. So we do sure. all these kind of media events where he'd be playing with the kids, and the media would just come and sort of like stand in front of where he was doing that, like right, you know, within his earshot and talk about him. And the PPOs would say to me like, oh, I can't do that. It's not royal. Like you can't have your back to a royal.
Yeah,
and I would
okay.
have to go and say to the media, actually, you can't really do that. You can't sort of like present in front of
yep,
him.
Yep.
And so we developed this relationship, because also like the media weren't really allowed to ask him questions, but of course they would start asking questions. And so
it's like, hey, Joe, go sort them out.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So it was this kind of like ongoing joke. So I got to know them really well. So I was on my way back down and I was like, oh, I'll go say goodnight to the PPOs before, because they were flying. He was like, oh, I'm flying out. We're doing like a changeover.
How many PPOs would he have around? Is it PPOs or POs?
I think it's private protection officer, so it's PPOs.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how many would he have
one or two, because we also had Vic Pol with us.
Oh,
as well.
Gotcha. Yep.
So it's like, it's not a big, it's not like if the Queen came or
sure,
something like that.
Sure.
And he's pretty chill, but they do have
they're armed and everything.
I actually genuinely don't know
okay.
if PPOs are armed.
Yeah. I mean, they're private bodyguards, so I'm assuming
they would be
there.
I don't know what the rules are in Australia in sure. terms of what Vic Pol would allow. But anyway, I honestly can't tell you. But I went downstairs to say goodnight to them. And as I was saying goodnight to him, Prince Edward opened the door to his room.
Oh, yeah.
I was kind of like, oh, I don't know what to do. But I like bowed away, because I just had a total like, this is not really, yeah. Anyway, so that was my
just
only
like
one.
Just like wave at him?
I think like I just sort of stepped aside because I just don't know what it's obviously like not etiquette for me to be like at his door. But anyway, that was like the only, but otherwise, like other than that, he's so lovely. He's really chill.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, so then I just started doing contract work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then freelancing as well with some other clients. And then I just started talking to my other friends who are creatives down here, just starting to talk about how the industry was so different here.
Mm-hmm.
My big thing was about like experience economy, and how particularly in retail and things like that, they're sort of not on that bandwagon here. And And just in terms of like the way that the different arts are integrated, particularly in fashion, there hasn't been a lot of collaboration with the arts as there would be back in Europe. So for example, like whenever we would do stuff, we would be involving like, you know, performance art, and we'd be involving music, and we'd been involving hospitality, and it felt here like everything was kind of a bit siloed. So that was one of the other things. And then also like working in Denmark, like design thinking is just part of the way they design stuff.
Irrespective of what discipline you belong in.
Yeah. Like, whereas here in Australia, design, that you have service design, so like human-centered design thinking, but it's really applied to sort of like services. It's not really applied to the things that like the sort of more sort of fluffy types of design like fashion or whatever. Particularly not, it's not really being applied to retail, which I found to be sort of mind-blowing. And so I started getting really interested in design research because it was really similar to psychology in a way, where you were using like a much more flexible way of like much more flexible research methodology to understand the sort of more fuzzy, hard to sort of quantify things about design, which is like emotions and cognition and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I actually, and there's a really big service design community here in Melbourne. So I actually retrained in service design. And there's just had these flowing conversations with various different creatives. Another friend who worked in the built environment in design, in Copenhagen, and a fashion creative director. And we started talking about why can't we do more kind of experience-driven events that act as marketing? Because we feel like it was lacking in a lot of like brands being doing more event stuff, particularly in retail. But also, couldn't we use those events as a way to do research? And to sort of for brands to sort of understand better about their customers and things like that. And so that's how the collective started.
What's the name of the?
So it's called Collective Futures.
Collective Futures.
So we do design research through arts and cultural activities, or like installations, experiences, mostly like immersive sensory experiences. And then we sort of quickly realized that a huge part of what we were doing was about driving connection. And it was also about driving change as well. And we actually sort of got totally off being client focused, so moving away from an agency and being more sort of impact work. And so now we're, because we also started involving service designers as well in the process, so now we're sort of a team of creative directors from fashion, so like styling, art direction. We have designers in the more sort of aesthetic design, so again art direction, but also built environment, so installations and things like that, and that we also have service designers, and then me, who's kind of does like events marketing and now a little bit of service design as well. And what we do is all about driving connection between communities, so it's about affecting change at the community level.
Before we delve in deeper into kind of the day-to-day and what a typical project looks like, you mentioned earlier experience economy. Can you define that for us?
The experience economy, I think it's basically that consumers now are more interested in having experiences than they are in buying products. And that in order to sell a product, it's about telling a story, and you tell that story through physical experiences. And, you know, that experience can be both digital or physical, but I think physical, you can never replace the type of connection or the type of emotional stimulation you get from a physical experience. And I think that's why, like, whether you're trying to sell a product or whether you're trying to, like, drive change, having physical experiences is the best way to tell that story and to really engage with people. So I think that's kind of really what the experience economy is about now. My big interest in that is retail, because I think that people, particularly here in Australia, that's not what people are getting. And that is kind of where people want to go. I think like there's a new centre that just opened up in, it's called Brickworks. And they put an urban farm
Here in Victoria?
In Melbourne, and it's kind of supposed to be like a green kind of shopping mall. And I was kind of like, okay, people are starting to realise that you have to be delivering like a non-retail experience. People need to be going there to kind of for a different reason than going shopping. People don't want to go and do that anymore. People don't want to just shop. They want to kind of experience things.
But the shopping is there by default if they were to walk out with a piece of clothing.
I think it's still a bit two-dimensional. Like, I don't think you can just build a farm and then have a shopping centre underneath and expect people are going to buy the products. I think they're sort of of like the store of the future is really going to be either replenish economy. So that's sort of like fast moving consumer goods. So like Amazon's got like open end technology that's going on at the moment
mm-hmm.
where, you know, they're putting technology into fast moving consumer goods. So when they run out, you don't even need to buy the product again. It's got intelligence built in, so it just reorders it. Yeah, so you go on a subscription basis.
Yeah.
And that will probably be true for skincare, home and bathroom care, like your olive oil. That's kind of where the industry is moving.
Yeah, well.
25 cents.
That would be so handy. So that would be so good.
It will be, but it will also like continue this monopoly of like certain retailers on the e-commerce scene. So like 25 cents of every dollar in America is spent on Amazon.
Wow.
So like even, you know, Walmart's gone, well, it's falling. Traditional stores and things are sort of like moving away, and Amazon is kind of this giant, and Amazon doesn't even make most of its money from retail. It makes it from cloud-based technology. Yeah. So you're kind of like, well, you know, everyone's kind of lost, right? So like what will happen to retail, I believe, and there's a lot of research on that as well, is that like in order to survive, you're either going to be sort of like a data miner or an experience driver. So you are going to help brands tell a story through your retail platform.
Sure. Yeah. So what I'm hearing here is to survive in the retail game, your brick and mortar kind of experience has to be to a point where it's stimulating. Someone can walk into your space and they're consuming some sort of an experience that's a sub product of the product that you're selling.
100%. And you're getting the customer there because they want to be part of that experience. You're selling the product, maybe not right there on the spot, but in a sort of more holistic sense of like really getting that consumer to sort of engage with the brand story, because you're weaving that product into an experience and you're creating an association.
Absolutely.
Similar to like what we used to do with like traditional billboard advertising, like Coca-Cola and, you know, people having fun, and suddenly you're like, oh, if I drink Coke, I'm going to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't speak to consumers like that anymore. Like, you know, it used to just be that we fed people an advertisement through a magazine or through, you know, or through a billboard, and then like social media changed that and it became a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
On social media, you know, you can now sort of like buy a pair of, you know, high heels by like text messaging with a brand, you know, like a lot of global brands are doing that now as well. I think like the next frontier is really experiences. So it's not just being able to kind of like text and interact. It's like you want to go in there and you want to kind of have a whole entire holistic experience with the brand. Okay. Before you're going to purchase it, really. Yeah, so that's cool. And so that's where we started off with, basically, was this idea of like the power of physical experiences.
Did you guys all have to get together and kind of undertake the same research and kind of skill up at the same level? Or is it more so there's a small collective of you and then you're kind of just pulling talent as you feel the need to?
We do that more, like, so, and it's kind of, we're still finding our feet with the process between research and creativity, like what comes first.
Yeah.
We've now really defined the sort of research areas, which actually has been great for us because it's sort of, it's easier then for the creatives to design experiences around that.
So how do you define those areas? Like, do you start with like a problem space or a hypothesis, or like how does that begin?
Well, it's just jamming, really. So it's just kind of, it's always been about our various passion areas. And so it's always been trying to figure out like where's the alignment on that?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we actually first did was just, we're like, let's just do a project. Because you just sometimes need to get the juices flowing and kind of do something and
just
then
commit to it, see what the outcome will be.
Like, a whole part of design research and design thinking is not to have everything figured out before you do anything, 100%. You know? So you kind of iterate and you kind of play around. And I think that's kind of the process that we don't have the luxury of time and money to really be going, okay, let's sit down, you know, and create a whole entire business plan before we even do anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a collective. We're not incorporated as a company. Like, that's, you know, potentially in the future
what
we'd like to do. But for the time being, it was about like all of us being able to do what we want to do creatively without the limitations of a client.
Yeah.
Or sort of where the industry is up to. So that's kind of what we did. So we started out with a project with the NGV Design Week.
Yep, that was going to be my next question. Take us through a typical kind of scenario.
And the way that it worked as well was that, and the way that it does work is generally like one person in the collective might have a creative idea or have a sort of area of interest.
First of all, the NGV is huge. So how'd you guys manage to get in there?
Well, it's through Design Week. So through Design Week, you apply with ideas.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, if your idea is good enough, you get in. And then if your idea is even better, you get a grant. So that's where we...
Okay, so talk us through your idea that got
so,
you through.
So this was actually one of our collective members, Rachel, at the time was really interested in saunas. And she was really interested in... She lived in Denmark with me.
Okay.
And sauna culture is like a huge part of Danish culture.
Given the temperature over there?
But it's also really like a communal thing. It's like it's community building.
Okay.
And something that we were all really interested in as well, and again, this comes back to this whole idea of physical experiences, but also like the built environment, because that's also like we realised was another sort of commonality.
Mm-hmm.
We were really interested in placemaking, which is also why I'm interested in retail and that whole retail experience, because it's part of placemaking.
Yeah, of course.
And I think a problem in Australia, why we don't have great, thriving local retail industries, we kind of like, we're not very good at placemaking in a sense that kind of builds community and builds culture. And so we were all really interested in that as well. And given that it's design week, we wanted to do something around the built environment. And so they had an idea about building a sauna. In that, and to sort of test like how would sauna culture go here in Australia, given that it's not freezing cold like in Denmark.
Absolutely.
And so that kind of started as an idea, and we submitted that. But what we did was a whole lot of research around what we wanted to do was we wanted to sort of create like a real life. We did like real life rapid prototyping. So we created this like sauna, and then we tested it in real life. And what we were looking at was how the design of the installation, of this kind of like prototype for a potential public space, how did that affect social connectedness and psychological well-being?
Where was the sauna located?
It was out at Fairfield. So we put it out at Fairfield Amphitheatre. Okay. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Fairfield Amphitheatre.
A little bit.
Yeah, it's like on the Yarra.
Yeah.
And we actually, it's like this big outdoor amphitheatre, and we actually flooded the amphitheatre with a small...
The pictures online look amazing.
Yeah.
Is this the prototype though, or this is the final one?
This was just a prototype.
Yeah, okay.
So it was like this sort of lake thing, and then we stuck a structure in the middle. And it wasn't a working sauna. There was no heat.
Okay.
And the reason for that was twofold. The real reason is we just did not have the budget to be able to create the heat. But when we thought about it more, we were also like, do we even want heat? So it was this big question. If we can put the heat in, we can do that, but it's going to cost like loads more money than we realized.
Sure.
But then we were also like, the whole point is actually looking at like the sense of well-being, and if you remove the physical sense of what you're supposed to get well-being from, we're like, that's maybe even more interesting.
Yeah,
it's like,
wow.
Then we're really sort of narrowing down this idea of like connection and how that drives well-being. So we did this what's called service safaris, or applied ethnography, which is basically where you go out. It's a social research tool, but it's also a design research tool where you go out and you just observe people in various different either services or products or systems that you would be looking at redesigning. Mm-hmm. So we went to a whole lot of saunas. And
here in Melbourne?
Yeah. And no, because one of the girls, Rachel, whose main idea it was, she was from Sydney. So she went to Icebergs.
Okay.
You know the one in Icebergs that they have?
Yep.
And I went to the Mornington Peninsula. What's the one out there? That massive kind of like, that's like a whole spa sort of complex.
I'm not sure what it's called, but
I know what you mean.
My wife's been there several times.
Yeah. And then I often go to Fitzroy Pools a lot.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we started picking up on all these commonalities. We started having all these hypotheses about what is it that makes all these conversations happen? Because I don't know if you guys have used saunas very much, but what ends up happening is you make friends with people in your community and you...
Is it because of the close proximity in the sauna? Like you're sitting there, you're trying to do your thing, whatever that is, whether it's sweating your like last night's drinking or whatever the case may be, but you can't look anywhere else but to the next person if there is a next person. And if you're by yourself, you just lay down, right?
Yeah.
You just lay down on the bench.
Yeah.
Well, I think you have to make a call. I feel like you have to make a call. It's like, do I talk to this person or do I stay quiet? Because if you stay quiet for too long, the choice is made, like it's then hard to break in.
Well, so it's funny that you guys say that, because that's actually like two different points that we discovered in the research, like two separate things, exactly what you guys just said. So we found out that there was sort of seven characteristics or seven elements of the space that was driving or facilitating social connection and also an enhanced sense of well-being. Because what we found out was we had 130 people come and fully complete all the research.
Whoa.
We had around 300 people turn up, which was massive. Because
that's serious commitment.
Yeah, it was a 24-hour event, and we had 300 people turn up.
Yeah.
And
how did you advertise it? How did you promote this
thing? You know what? We just put up, like, I put up a $40 ad on Facebook, and we just had loads of people.
Wow.
And we were late. Like, the NGV didn't do any promotion for us. Okay. Not because they didn't want to or anything like that, or that they, you know, they refused to, but we were just really late with getting everything in.
Gotcha.
Because we were just having a real issue with finding a site. Yep. And so many other things.
And I'm assuming the financial commitment would have come out of your guys' pockets, or did you have some investment?
We got a grant from the NGV.
I beg your pardon. Yes, you did mention that.
So yeah.
Was the site visible? Like, was it like street foot traffic as well, or was it?
No. So because I don't know, Fairfield Amphitheatre is kind of like in, you know, it's you have to take like, you have to sort of drive down a hill to get there, and it's like in the middle of a big park, and there's not really much around except for like a rowing club next door.
Okay.
So there was a bit of foot traffic on the Sunday, but not a lot. Yeah. So it was really successful in terms of, I think what it showed was that people were really interested in the subject, like, and people were interested in Design Week. So we probably had some people find us through the NGV webpage.
Yep.
But there's also 100 events on through Design Week. We were free. I think that was like another big bonus.
Yep.
And then we were talking, it was kind of like this really novel thing where you're like, oh, you can be part of an event and you can kind of go to this like mock sauna that's also like an art installation, but also you can participate in research and then you can receive the results afterwards.
Gotcha. And did you find that people that turned up were more inclined towards design and research and that side of it, or was it just kind of a spectrum of different backgrounds and
mixed bag? So that's like something else that's really interesting that we're looking at. I just submitted a paper to the ServDes 2020 conference, which is like a big international conference on service design, which is being hosted here in Melbourne next year, around like our methodology and how can that add to the design practice. And one of the limitations that I did say was this, like, being able to control the demographic, the population demographic. Really interestingly, our demographic ended up being really similar to that of the demographic of Melbourne. The medium age of the demographic of Melbourne is 35, and our medium age was 32, and our average age was 35.
Incredible.
And we had a bit more, we had sort of, I think it was around 70% females, no, 60% females, 30% men, and then 10% of people didn't
identify.
Didn't record a gender, because we didn't have like a drop down menu. You just had to write what your gender was. So
was this done pre installation? Like, did they do this online, or how did you capture this information?
So we captured obviously their like emails and names and things through Eventbrite. So they signed up through Facebook, or they signed up directly through the NGV website, and then that was done through Eventbrite. But in order to make sure that we knew that the people that had were coming, that we actually, they were the actual people, people did a survey before they went into the space a survey after the space. So, and they had to write their name and their email and their postcode and their age and their gender. And then the way that we did the research was, it was very much like entwined into the experience. So if you went, it was really difficult to know what was being researched and what wasn't. So we had like a launch night where we had like performance art, and we had these women women and men who were like water bearers. So we had these guys on keyboards doing synths and like all this kind of stuff. And you sat down and you could put on an eye mask.
Okay.
And then we did this group meditation to this poem.
And this is all online. Like, can we watch videos and stuff?
You can see some.
We'll link in the show notes as well, just so our listeners can see what you're talking about, because it was super relaxing.
It was very relaxing.
I looked at the photos on the website. It looks really cool. And like the people dancing on the water.
Yeah.
Like that looks amazing.
Yeah. Wow. So we did all this kind of like performance art and all this kind of stuff that really wasn't part of the research, but it was so woven in that people couldn't be able to distinguish between the two, which was nice because you're just there for a sort of experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. So it means that you're not leading anyone in the research because they don't know.
So we were sort of following what's kind of like similar to what's called a living lab, of which there's not a lot here in Australia. It's sort of more popular in Europe, but it's a type of design research where it's kind of they do a lot of research in real life settings.
Okay.
And so that's kind of what we were trying to create. And that was, we wanted to, this idea, a lot of the service designers that we work with are always a bit questionable about the people that they're using to do the research, because you go through a recruitment agency who charges you $300 an hour to interview these people if you're doing like, say, like a contextual inquiry and you're doing these one-on-one interviews, which are really popular in design research, and you're sort of like, who are these people that sign up to these agencies? I don't know one person who signed up. So who are these?
How legit are they as well?
Exactly. Mm. So that's kind of what we were trying to do, was trying to get real people that would genuinely engage in a new public space in Melbourne in the area to kind of be part of the research. So we did a whole lot of different sort of art and cultural kind of experiences, and then we did a whole lot of sort of research as well. And so on the launch night, people filled out this, which was really a survey, but we called it like a personal reflection piece.
Okay.
So people, and then, you know, you went on to like a meditation, and then you watched these dances, and then you did like another reflection. And so people were like, oh, that was kind of, you know, a sort of mindfulness activity.
It's kind of like a debrief on the experience.
but it was actually the research.
Yeah, wow.
So we hit like a well-being scale in that and all this other
stuff. You guys just kind of weave that in there without knowing.
But so it was really great. And we found that we had, I can't remember the exact statistics, but we had I think it was close to 60% of people felt less lonely.
Wow.
After visiting, something like 70-something% felt less anxious, more relaxed, more at ease.
That's incredible.
More connected to others.
Yeah.
And a big part of the research that we were doing was around loneliness. So because it's sort of like the next public health crisis, one in four Australians are lonely and it's becoming worse. And it's a lot to do with how we live now. And we
being behind screens and
being behind screens is definitely part of it, but it's also like, you know, more than ever we're living alone. We live in a small amount of space, we live alone, we travel further to get to work, so we're spending more time commuting, we're moving a lot more for work, so you move interstate overseas. You're just not that invested in your community, you're spending less time in your community, and you're not that connected to people because you're living alone. And at the same time, you know, because we're living in these like smaller spaces, we do have a greater need to share spaces. So there's like a rapid rise in co-working spaces and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, like public space is being degraded and there's less of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the point of our research for this particular project was looking at how can we rethink public space for the good of the community? How can we address some of the issues to do with urbanization, such as loneliness?
You've had some amazing results come out of this. How has this been perceived by the general public and people in design, and how has that put you on the map now to kind of engage other kind of agencies or government bodies and build on that momentum?
Yeah, so that's something that we're working on, and I think that's actually is a struggle of being a side hustle, and particularly all being freelancers, is a scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like we finding time when one of us is not on a full-time contract is really difficult. I'm really lucky because I ended up getting rid of all of my freelance work around sort of June, July this year, and just doing 3 days a week at the youth development charity that I was talking about before. So that I could just spend 2 days a week on the collective. And then because the nature of my work is I'm, you know, marketing, so I'm not necessarily like project based. I can just be working with the company a couple of days a week. But if you're a stylist, for example, you might be put on a project for like a week, and then it's like full on like 10, 12 hours a day at another location. So that's been one of our challenges, is like is using the momentum of the results to then engage with more, to getting more clients and to getting more projects. We are in dialogue with a few different programming companies, organizations. So rather than going down client route, we're trying to go down teaming up with other sort of organizations that are doing programming in Australia or in Victoria primarily, or Melbourne. So, you know, fashion weeks and other sort of like arts and cultural things. So we're in discussions with them and developing ideas with them. And it's relying basically on grants. So that's kind of where we're at the moment in terms of that. In terms of design community, I'm really hoping that we do get into the CERVDES conference. Because if we do get into that, that would be, we'd have a published article, which would be great. So like a published research article, which I think for us is where we really want to go, is trying to make sure that our research stands up as credible research. That's where we are in terms of the general public. We have the nature of doing events and the way that we did it means that we haven't engaged. That was our first event and we had no you know, we didn't have an Instagram, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have a mailing list.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we had like 300 people on a mailing list, and we have like an Instagram and a Facebook, and things are moving. And so that was really great because that helped us to kind of have a platform. But it does, it takes time to grow. So, and that's kind of where we're at right now, is kind of how do we create like a rhythm,
a flow,
you know, definitely. Because I think that is the challenge with the nature of the work that we're doing. It's kind of, and we've had these sort of discussions as a collective. Mm-hmm. Do we just want to be a portfolio for collaborative work that we do together?
Mm.
So is it the case that we just bring projects to the collective when it makes sense that we all work together, or do we actively seek work like an agency and, you know, start taking some real costs under the belt, like, you know, renting a space and all of that kind of stuff,
all the overheads and what have you,
you know? And we sort of, and it's been this back and forth conversation, which I think's been really interesting, because like I think it's like reframing the sort of the pillars of what a successful company looks like. And I think all of us came into this because we were frustrated with agency work.
Mm-hmm.
We were frustrated with taking, we saw an industry where you have like the client who then engages an agency who then takes a huge chunk of the money, and then the creative gets paid not particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's this kind of like fight also always over expenses and whatever. And then the end result is a lot less than it could be. And,
definitely.
And as creatives, you're getting frustrated because you're like, oh, well, you know, if the client knew that I just needed like $2,000 more budget, they probably would give it, but you're not allowed to have that conversation with the client,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, and that's just the nature of the way that the industry works, and agencies have huge overheads, and it's, you know, it's always a game where you have consistent overheads, but the work is inconsistent.
Yes.
And so it's just like, you know, it's, and then you suddenly have to take a project in because you've got to pay payroll, you know? And so we were like, we don't want to be like that. That's kind of,
it defeats the entire purpose because you're trying to get away from that.
Exactly. So interesting.
I've seen that cycle as well. I used to work in an agency, haven't worked in an agency for a while. And that's the reason why I left, because I kept seeing that cycle happen, that pay cycle to feed everyone that works for the agency, I guess. And it's fascinating the way you guys are going about it and the way the research is forming. What I'm wondering is, I do a lot of research in my role, but it's quite more different, I guess. It's more like that UX style research.
Yep.
And when I say different, I mean this one sounds way more exciting and way more fun. But what I'm interested in is, I guess, that strategy, like the planning piece before like the implementation. Like how does that look?
Yeah, well, it's like that was also something that was really interesting in terms of like how do we engage people in the more in-depth research. So I guess you'll know as a UX designer, like it's sometimes not just a survey, you know, you need to sit down and like do like an hour with people. The planning has been the research has been kind of not, I wouldn't say easy, but like we've been really fortunate. We've got two service designers. One is a director at one of the largest service design companies here in Melbourne, and another one works in a sort of relatively similar size as well, and he's a lead service designer. And so like actually that's been one of the easier parts, because they're just kind of, they're used to working in a flexible, they're used to kind of having to be flexible with their research.
Yeah.
I think it'd be easier than working, say, with someone who's doing like clinical psychology research. I mean, that would we wouldn't be able to do that kind of research. So the planning is really just figuring out how are we going to do it on site? Do we do it all on site? How much do we do beforehand?
Mm-hmm.
We're always having these philosophical discussions about the methodology. Mm-hmm. So when I submitted the paper, I was saying that we followed the double diamond. I don't know if you're familiar with diamond. And one of my, Mark, who's also in the collective, he was like, I don't know if we actually did, because did we actually end up with a product? Because we ended up with insights, not an actual, you know. And I was like, but can design research be a product? And so we went on this like, you know, and so, yeah, that's an ongoing discussion, the planning beforehand.
Yeah. I've been thinking the exact same thing. Like, is there a version of this where you don't have to have a delivery? There's no like engineering, there's no product. Like,
yeah, our deliverable is research.
Yeah.
And then it's this ongoing question of, well, do we want to get into the business of actually designing things rather than just experiences?
Like actually execute up on the research findings.
Yeah.
Mm.
And that's another question. I think My personal belief in, and first of all, it's a passion project. Like, I would very much like us to be able to do this full time, but I don't need to do it so quickly as to risk what the quality of what we're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's been my big lesson in all of this, is not giving into that pressure of believing that the success of your project is how fast you grow, how quickly. You know, because I think that is, and you know, I'm reading more and more as well about all these sort of like unicorn, you know, startups, and how they're, even the startup industry is starting to go like, maybe that's actually not a great measure. Maybe we shouldn't be trying to push these companies to grow so quickly.
We need to pump the brakes a little bit and really figure things out before we start taking investment. And
100%, you know, yeah. And also not having, I think it's good also not to necessarily be so fixated on exactly what you want to end up being. So I think it's really good to sit down and have like really clear mission, a really clear like brand values, to have a really clear brand DNA. I mean, this is a big part of what I do normally in my job in marketing and comms is, and as I was saying to you before about doing the master thing, like being a coach, a lot of what I do is walk people through like, how do you, you must have a brand DNA before you can move on to any step. So I do believe that you need to have a really clear understanding of what you stand for and who you are and how that looks and sounds, like both from like a visual perspective, but also like a visual identity perspective, but also like a written, you know, you're able to have that elevator pitch.
Totally.
But you need to be flexible that that might change, and what does that actually look like as well? Because you can have these pillars and this brand DNA and this kind of really clear idea about where, you know, what you are, but actually what you end up creating might be really
different.
So I think that's been another lesson, is that flexibility about where are we going. And so, yeah, we could do things, I think, a bit differently, but like, I think if we wanted to do things differently, we'd all kind of have to make a commitment of quitting our jobs and getting investment and just going whole hog. And it's another story.
What I wanted to know, I mean, clearly you're very passionate about this, like talking about research, talking about people, talking about communities, and getting everyone in that one space and kind of figuring out how humanity can better service itself, pretty much, across different industries. How do you balance that with your current 9-to-5 or contracts? It seems like there's a lot to think about, and you're a very driven person, obviously, from what we've heard so far. So how do you balance the kind of commitment towards your 9-to-5 and then having to really push the envelope with your passion?
I think it does just come back to that, allowing things to take their time, not to get anxious that you haven't had a project in 3 months or you haven't done this, and realizing like being able to see the value in incremental gains and looking, sort of flipping that perspective and going, okay, well, you know, we haven't done this, but we've done this, you know, and it's just taken a bit longer. And then I think people get really concerned that if you haven't seen that growth, that it means that you're not, that it is going to fail or it's never going to take off. And I think just having that like faith that things are going to keep working, and you can, you know, people take time away from things. Like I see all the time, like friends take time out from things and then suddenly they're back on Instagram and the business is going really well. And you're like, I didn't notice that you weren't posting anything.
Right.
I didn't notice that you weren't necessarily doing anything. I only noticed
really
when you do stuff, you know. People, particularly when you come from marketing and social media, it's like, you know, you must post X amount of times per week, be top of mind, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, sure. If you've got a product that you have manufactured and you've got that whole risk there sitting there in like stock that you need to sell, yeah, you need to be top of mind. Yeah, you need to be selling. Otherwise, you're going to lose money. But if you're not really making money and you don't really have any like products sitting in the warehouse that need to be sold, and you don't have any overheads and you don't have any costs, it's okay that maybe for a month nothing gets posted on social media. No one is going to notice.
Yeah, I totally agree. I did the Instagram thing for about 8 months, like really, really heavy. So I was just creating I was just designing for fun. And the fun design was the fun part. Like I was just making graphics for fun. But then I started to get into this. I started to watch YouTube clips of like how to grow it and all that sort of stuff. And the things that I learned of like stories and how many per day and the time to post and then the likes and comments and all this sort of stuff, it turned into like a bit of a game. So at first it was really fun. At first it was like maybe first 3 months, it was like a really fun game where I was just like every day get up, like a couple of things, comment a couple of things and like get things ready to post and do all that sort of stuff. And it grew pretty well and I was getting like heaps of inquiries. It became my new folio. But then there seemed to be there's a moment where it got to a point where I just was like, it just like a flick switched. And I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, yeah. it's just too much. Like, what am I actually getting out of
this? It's a full-time job taking care of a social media account, or it can be.
It is. And I think influencers, you've got to be a certain type of person to kind of welcome that type of attention. I mean, for me, I'm quite a private person. So having to post up about myself and what I had for dinner and breakfast and blah, 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 like, I can't be doing that. Like, yeah. I'd rather keep that to myself. I'm not the type of person.
Yeah.
What I wanted to know is, obviously there's a huge part of what you do revolves around empathy.
Yep.
And people mapping and all that stuff. So take us back a little bit and tell us a little bit more about your background and kind of how you started to see the world a little bit with a different mindset or a different lens. Because we know you mentioned that you were living in Denmark and you surrounded yourself in this communities where you'd go to a sauna and kind of talk to different people and what have you. But obviously there must have been something when you were kind of a lot younger that kind of tapped into that part of you as a person that you've kind of seemed to have grown with.
Well, I think I've always been really interested to try to understand the world and the way that people relate to each other, which is how I ended up doing psychology, studying psychology.
Sure.
Yep. So it's always been something that I've been really interested in.
But did something happen like at a young age, like an incident at school or something?
I think like I've moved quite a lot. So I'm from a big family. I'm one of four kids. And both my parents are one of five. I've got loads of cousins.
Gotcha. There's
like lots of family dynamic going on.
Okay.
I was born in Sydney. We moved to Canada. I was there for four years, I think. Then we moved back to Newcastle.
Moved to Canada because of your parents?
Yeah, my dad's work. So gotcha. Both my dad's a cardiologist and he was doing his some sort of study fellowship there.
Yeah.
And then we moved back to Newcastle for him for his job.
Sure.
So he was at the John Hunter, which is a big hospital up there.
Right.
And then I went actually to boarding school.
Okay.
And then I left boarding school and I had a year in Sydney. And then I moved to Canberra for 5-6 years. Then I moved to London for a year. Then I moved to Denmark for 5-6 years.
Okay.
And then I think what all that does is you're so exposed to all these different environments.
Yep.
And you're also exposed to the way that people relate to each other and how your environment affects you.
Well, there's different cultures, like Canberra in comparison to Newcastle, that's like night and day.
Yeah. So true.
And then you're off to Canada, which is fully happening. And then you're off to Denmark, which is different in so many different levels in terms of how they live their lives, temperature, daylight, all that stuff. I'm pretty sure all that stuff kind of, contributed towards your thought process.
Exactly. So I think I've always been this part of me that's always been like really academically interested. Like I've always had that kind of desire to understand can we say that for certain? Mm-hmm. I've always been driven by that.
You're the annoying kid like at the dinner table. 100%. You're always questioning your parents.
So much like that. And both my parents are doctors. Both my mum and my dad's dad were doctors.
Yeah, wow.
That sort of like medical thing, I guess, runs in the family. Yeah. Ironically, none of us are doctors. None of us. I came the closest doing psychology, and then I did my honours in psychophysics.
Were you like the last hope for your parents that one of our kids is going to make it?
My mum was kind of like, well, you're already doing a Bachelor of Science. You could just switch over. And I actually really think I would have really loved it. But the idea of just doing the road to becoming a doctor, once you're already like 3 years deep into undergrad, you're like, nah.
It's like another 5 years of PhD and then...
Yeah, like doing like post-grad medicine. And then,
my dad is a doctor, so I fully understand what you're saying.
It's a long road. And and then I guess like the human element of just work. I love working with people. And I guess as a doctor, you do work with people, but you don't work as a team necessarily. I guess my dad would say he does as a surgeon, but like it's not the same as...
It's not
about managing people and it's not about, it's different. So I guess I'm glad I didn't go down that route. But I think, I've always had that science kind of desire to understand facts and how research can tell us more about humans and our understanding. But then I've always been really interested in the arts and fashion and clothes and colours and all of that kind of stuff. So that's why I like this part of me when I was at ANU was like very serious and doing this serious degree, and I kind of felt like I couldn't really step away from that. And then I kind of was like, nah, I'm doing it.
Okay.
And I moved to Copenhagen, and for me, like Danish design is just, it was just, I was like, why doesn't everyone you know, dress like this and live like this. And even students have like really nice apartments with really nice furniture. And I was just kind of like, you know, this is a Mecca. Like this is,
definitely,
you know, this is a utopia. And socially they're a bit of a utopia as well. Yeah. I mean, they obviously have their dysfunctions as well, but I felt very akin to a lot of the values socially there. So that was kind of really interesting for me as well. And so looking at how that affects society, like they say in Denmark, you can go to a dinner party and there'll be like a plumber, a lawyer, you know, a hairdresser, a homeless person, and like a prince, and that's like a normal dinner.
But everyone shares the same type of respect around the table. And
you can't tell the difference between anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't. Like there's some differences in not necessarily dialect, but accent based on like the region that you're from. And obviously typically like Copenhagen versus regional Denmark, maybe there's a difference in, you know, SES, but probably not really. Like, so you just can't, like, and everyone kind of has like a nice design sensibility. Like, I just don't think they really have, like, you know, in Australia we have like that term bogan. Like, it doesn't, you can't really find that in Denmark. Kind of, you know,
just classy, doing their thing.
Yeah, and just like, and you can't tell how much money someone has, and there just isn't those big divides anyway.
Gotcha.
Because of the way that the tax system works and things like that.
So those barriers or those social kind of stereotypes have been removed. By default, because of their culture.
They're still a capitalist country, and so there will be that, but it's just way less extreme than it is here in Australia.
Yeah.
And then they're just better at community.
They just
understand it. They've got a more collectivist culture. They've got a different, they have like two types of ownership in terms of real estate. So you have eier, which means you own it outright, but then you also have something called andeel, which is, or andeel for eening, which is, I guess it's kind of like a co-op, but it's more collectively owned than that. So you buy a share in the building and you sort of like collectively manage it, but the price per square meter is set by the government and it's lower, so it's really affordable. So lots of people own their homes and it's not that expensive. You pay a bit more in like monthly bills or rent, but then you own it, you know. So you have this kind of, and but you can't really make money from selling it because this, you know, the price per square meter is set. And so even that, like even just the way that they live is more collective, you know. And so I guess. And my friend who also is in the collective, Rachel, so she's no longer in the collective because she's up in Sydney, and it's just like that's another thing we've realized is that location is a really big determinant to how well you collectively work together.
Yeah.
Even though you think this whole kind of
with technology, remote, and Zoom and Skype, whatever,
it's actually really hard.
I totally agree that face to face, nothing can beat it, especially when you're trying to sit down and resolve some sort of a problem or come up with some sort of a design solution. You definitely need that round table discussion. Yeah,
like she was flying down all the time.
Yeah, it's just not feasible.
It's just not feasible. So that was like a big thing as well. But we started, she was a big part of starting the collective. Like she was one of the original founders and we still collaborate with her as well. But she had that same experience that I did of being like that design sensibility, that design thinking, and just like, placemaking, all of that kind of stuff. So I guess it is this sort of culmination of this kind of like the research sort of serious part, a sort of idea about like how can we be more collectivist, how can we be more community orientated, and then also like art and culture and design as well, and sort of like a mesh of those.
Definitely. So do you see the collective as like a bit of a mentor advisor sort of ship, like do you guys sort of mentor each other, or do you have mentors through your travels or anything like that as well?
It's like a really interesting point about mentors. I think in a way we could actually be better at that, mentoring each other, because we have these very individual skill sets. I definitely think for me, like the retraining in the service design thing happened because of those, like those friendships that I made and just talking about that. And that gave me the confidence to be like, oh, I could go and retrain in that, you know, just by being part of the collective, it gave me that kind of permission to study. And then having them and talking to them, and that they, particularly Caroline, she's coming on as a more advisory role rather than like a sort of core member. And she's been really great too, because I run everything past her in terms of like, you know, so I was studying, I was doing these projects, and then I was saying to her like, okay, I'll design the research, but can you look over it and give me some feedback and things like that. And so, yeah, like we definitely do have that element, but I think we could probably be better at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, mentorship is a really interesting thing that I feel like I've lacked having a little bit in my career that I would like to, but I don't even know how you go about finding a mentor. I find that whole process kind of really challenging.
Yeah. I can totally relate. It's throughout my entire career, my 9-to-5 side hustles, I think I'm yet to find a mentor, but I've somehow identified with someone recently and I'm like, shit, you've been here the whole time. I think you're my mentor.
Yeah, right.
And it's not because they've lacked in giving me advice. As a matter of fact, they've just let me do my own thing and then they've just kind of debriefed with me every single time I've gone out there and I've done something a little bit out of the ordinary.
You know they're there for any questions that you might have or anything like that.
Yeah, it's kind of like a safety net, but someone that can also check you and say, hey, look, you could have moved in this kind of way as opposed to, you know, what you did.
Is that a mentor for you professionally in terms of the work that you're doing or professionally in terms of your career progression?
That's a good question. I see the two kind of combining almost because whatever I'm doing for my career is also benefiting my everything else that I'm doing on the side. So I kind of see them not as two separate entities. I see them as one.
Yeah, right.
Because in the end of the day, business is business, irrespective of designing something for people to kind of, you know, commute in or, you know, gather in, or you're building a product that someone can use for the rest of their lives to, you know, consume. So yeah, it's, I see them in the same kind of vein. Sorry, did that answer your question?
Well, it's more like, because I think I've definitely had people in jobs where I feel like they've been a mentor in terms of the skill or the craft or sort of how you do your job, but not necessarily like whole picture. Like I've yet to find someone who's like, who I feel like I could ask, like, you know, should I go this way or this way? I think a big part of that is definitely like moving from one country. Like I moved from Denmark, but we were quite a global platform. So most half of my colleagues were from the UK.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I had definitely had one mentor there, Nancy, and she was so great. She was much older, but she was so cool. She was like life of the party. She had more energy than I did. She was just like a woman about town. If you wanted to get into any club anywhere or any restaurant, she was your girl.
Yeah.
We were going to the Chilton Firehouse when it like first opened.
Yeah.
Like, it was, you know, she was great. She's like 60 and has like half blue hair and like killer body and like, you know, just those kind of people. And she was just like total energy just the whole time.
Free spirit.
But she was so good at her job and I learned so much from her about how to, she kept saying like a dog with a bone. So like if someone said no to you, she would just, no shame, just keep pushing. And I think as a young, when I first started out and particularly maybe also as a woman, that that kind of like, not aggressiveness, I don't want to say aggressiveness, but that kind of like fearlessness in terms of
that go-getter type
sales kind of. And I wasn't necessarily in a sales role, but I was like trying to secure a whole lot of like special projects and things like that.
Absolutely.
And she was just like, no, just keep pestering them. Don't take no. And the way that she did it was with such confidence that it kind of came across really well. And I learned a lot from that. And I've had other people in my career in other various organizations where I've learned from, but I've never had someone that I felt like I could talk to about where to next.
Yeah.
What's the right move?
Yeah, I think the where to next is something that I haven't found as well, now that you frame it that way. But I think the professional part in terms of the sales, in terms of that go-getter attitude, how do you handle certain scenarios if a situation happens and you need to kind of look after a group of people or mentor a group of people. So I'm learning more from on that front, and that's only come into my life recently. So the entire time I've just been depending on myself and kind of just trial and error. But I think that one person that you can go to for life skills and professional skills would probably be my mom.
Yeah,
she's a boss lady. I think I've spoken about her.
What does she do?
She was the CFO in the UN office in Baghdad.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And she's the one that got us out of the Middle East. She's the one that's been provided for us when we were younger, my brother and I. I've got a twin brother.
Oh, wow.
So I just look up to her for any type of advice, whether it's relationship, personal, work related.
All of the above.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's great, because I like have a deep respect for my parents' jobs, But like, it's got, I can't ask them anything about work really, because you know,
there's no relatability in
well,
there.
Particularly this idea of like, start, you know, your career and being sort of like, you know, more of a jungle gym than a ladder, and like, you know, sort of like transitioning to different industries and sidestepping and all of that kind of stuff. Like, they can't relate, because as a doctor, you know, you've got you get your degree.
Very systematic.
It's like one line, you know, and you just keep going up that line, and it's like, you know, it's there's a lot of job security. You know, it's a very clear path. How do you build that career?
Mm-hmm.
I think recently, my mum has actually had a bit of not difficulty at all, and I actually think she's like really benefited from it, because she's really like come into her own with a lot of stuff, but through work stuff. But she's done loads of different stuff, because she was working up in the NT for a while, working with the communities up there, and then that. The NT government stopped giving that contract to senior doctors and started giving it to junior doctors. And she was kind of like, oh, what do I do? And
right. She
was doing locums and all sorts of things, but she's built like a whole lot of other interests, because she hasn't had the straight line career that my dad has had. My dad's now is the head of cardiology at the John, and he's like going to retire soon, you know, and I can tell that
and
he's
that's all he knows. That's his entire life has just been dedicated to that.
Yeah,
I don't know how you could live like that. Like thinking about our sidestepping in jungle gym, like I kind of feel like we don't have strong mentors because we sort of have the side hustles and we know how to do it for ourselves.
Mm.
We sort of like, I feel from my point of view, the mentors that I look at is like, they don't know them, that they're my mentor. I'm just like soaking everything from them.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I feel like I've capped design and I want to get to the next level, and design's capping me at the moment.
Mm.
So I'm looking at like the CEO of where I work, 99 Designs, and like the head of product. I'm just watching very critically on what they're doing and like soaking everything in. I know what to do, what not to do based on like how they're speaking and the language they're using and how they're conducting themselves.
Mm.
And I kind of wonder if that's sort of like a skill that we all have with all these side hustles, is because we're trying to do things and we can do so many things. Is we're just sort of like soaking up in a different level.
Yeah, well, I think our generation is the one that's a bit more curious, because we were the first generation to kind of experience the analog world and then the digital world.
Mm.
So we knew what it was to play outside and hang out with friends and ride a bicycle outside.
We did.
To now being behind screens. So we understand what that balance could look like.
Mm.
We also know what the dial tone sounds like when you dial up for the
dial up.
Like Gen Z doesn't even know what that is.
Or a floppy drive, like what that actual save icon is.
Totally.
Like a music cassette, when you sit down, listen to the radio and you're about to hit record and play, or record and something at the same time to record a song from an FM radio station,
and hope they don't speak over the end.
Yeah,
please don't speak
so
over the end.
That's right.
So, to my point is that I think we're a lot more curious because we've got all this information in front of us, and we hold ourselves in a different kind of responsibility, accountability in terms of how we can cater to kind of humanity as a whole, because we're in industries where we can make a difference, but where do you start and where do you end up going with it?
Yeah. Mm. I think the other really interesting thing is that we come from a generation that does straddle that kind of the employment landscape changing. Like, as you said about the sort of analog digital, it's been the same for us in terms of like jobs of the future and like robots and all the rest of it. And like, you know, young people now, Gen Z, a lot of what the work that I was doing, what I do with the youth development program, is we have a big contract from the government to do professional development for teachers. And we actually engaged with a social researcher, Claire Madden, who's written a book on Gen Z and how they engage with communication, all that kind of stuff. And a big thing is about like the way that the employment market is changing and things like that.
Yeah.
And Gen Z are going to have something like seven different, like they're going to change jobs 21 times and have like seven different industry job changes.
Yeah, wow.
And they're at school and they're learning that. Like they're being told like, you've got to prep for that. You've got to soft skills and like, unemployment and all this kind of stuff, and they're really, you know, having to think about that sort of like flexible mindset when it comes to a career. And they're not thinking doctor, lawyer, accountant. They're thinking, you know, I'm going to change my job all the time. I'm flexible and entrepreneur and all this kind of stuff. And there's all these way different jobs. And we grew up more being like, these very kind of like careers, like what do you want to be when you grow up? And you kind of, at least I had this perspective that I was probably just going to have a career, you know, in one area. And I studied for that, you know. And then it was this kind of shock at sort of like 29, 30 when everyone's kind of, and you yourself are like, oh, I've got these possibilities and I could kind of step here or step there. And I had all these friends. And maybe that's going to this sort of like the kind of school that I went to, which was very kind of focused on getting you into university and getting you into these more kind of like very white collar jobs, you know. A lot of my friends who were in sort of like consultancy or, you know, finance or whatever were like, this is not what I want to be doing and I don't have to. And sort of quit and, you know, become life coaches or go and do development work or, you know, started, you know, startup or change into, I had a friend who was working for SPCC, like the, you know, the Tin Fruit brand in marketing. She was like really bright at school. She got one of those cadetships into, it's the same company that owns Coca-Cola here in Australia. And she was working as like head of marketing like that. And then she quit that to become a tarot card reader.
Whoa.
Massive.
What?
And I have like, and you know what? She's doing really well with it. She's actually.
We wanted to talk to her, I think.
Yeah, you actually really should. She's great. I think her Instagram is like, I've got to remember it because it's really funny because it's something to do with like corporate actress or something, because what she realized when she needed to quit her job because she was just giving so many tarot card readings in the boardroom. Just like my whole day is this, you know, because there's all these like.
That is such a bizarre transition as well.
All these like super stressed out like people who are like, you know, tell me, you know, what's going to happen. Like,
you're like, sure, for $20.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so anyway, but she quit that to become a sort of a tarot card reader. And she does like past life regression, all that kind of stuff. But now she's actually in a marketing job, but in a company that's more aligned to her.
Gotcha.
And so she's kind of, you know, she's, I think she jumped like these big jumps because we're sort of told that you have to be on this one path and then you're suddenly allowed to go off the path.
Especially if you're someone like you growing up questioning every single thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not just
going
to take no for an answer and you're like, no, I'm going to see for myself.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
that's an interesting thought because I never thought of it that way, the like the single line, because when I was coming up through school into uni, I had that mentality as well, but I shoot myself so much about being in the same job for a long time. I like kept pivoting at uni. Like I pivoted every 6 months to a year to something different.
Yeah.
So I never really learned anything, but I learned like I did an architect, I did interior design for a year. And in that I learned if I keep going, I'm not good enough to be an architect. Mm. I'm probably going to become a draftsman. Yeah. I don't want to do that. You know what I mean? Like I learned enough to like know what I didn't want.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that thought, because now I feel it kind of did me a big service, because now I know how to be a jack of all trades. Like I can do that.
Yeah.
And I didn't fall into any single thing, I guess.
And so you do many different things. And I think that is like, that's sort of more permissible now, but it's also the future. It's also like, that's what they're teaching now. Through this organization, I also do a lot of university partnerships and they're like, oh, we're teaching our students how to design, think their career.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, that's so interesting. Cause of this whole idea about changing. And when I was at uni, that just wasn't, you know, that wasn't even a sort of thing that they were thinking about, you know? So what you kind of just did intuitively is what they're trying to get people to do now. They're trying to think like, how can you kind of understand what your skill set is and apply that to different industries and different jobs and have that kind of flexible mind to be able to move around, because that's really going to service you in the future. So
definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Joe, we're starting to wrap up here. So what I wanted to know is obviously a very kind of cliche question, but I think it's a very important one. With Collective Futures, where do you see that heading? I mean, I know NGV kind of set you on the map and it gave you a really cool kind of launch pad to speak about what your mission is and what you've accomplished, which has been outstanding. But I wanted to understand, what would be the next ideal project for you guys?
Yeah, I think we've defined three different research areas under this idea of like connected communities. So connected and healthy communities. We have, again, this idea of public spaces for wellbeing and connection.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have the idea of thriving local retail, which goes back to that whole idea of the story of the future. And
sure.
Like making sure that like if local retail needs to be thriving, for connection as well, the high street, that whole idea of like having that local high street and not losing that, but also about like having local brands and local creativity. It's so important. Without a retail industry, we're not going to have that. And then the third one is around community owned solutions for like waste, energy and food. And so ideally what I would love to see next year is that we have a project on each one of those. And we start to build research. And what I would really like to do is to really build up a whole lot of research on each of those different topics. Enough that we are able to eventually collaborate with someone to produce a solution or...
Would these be government kind of contracts that you'd be looking out for, or would you want to collaborate with actual retailers?
Collaborating, so, well, not... maybe with retailers. So I'm in discussions with a few different organisations that I probably can't really name, other NGOs or other sort of social enterprises who are working on solutions. Like there's one that's working on a solution for community-owned waste. So I know that's a big thing that everyone's talking about, like what is actually happening with our recycling, like where's it going? Also with composting, a lot of people have a lot of organic matter. They're working on how to... they've already sort of halfway there, but they need community engagement to kind of develop the service more and to kind of also work out how to engage the community to actually like use it. And so, you know, we're talking about doing something together where we do some sort of like arts and cultural event, because she was sort of saying to me, oh, you know, this company did this whole thing around waste and they did this art performance, and then they told me they got all this money as a grant to do that. And I said, yeah, because there's actually quite a lot of money in like arts and cultural programming. And so she was like, well, I know nothing about that. And I was like, great, well, we do. So that's like an example. We're also talking to a another large art museum institution about doing something totally ad hoc with them. And then I'm talking to another company who would sponsor that.
Exciting.
Yeah, which is
so
really...
So are you the one kind of piecing all the... is it the puzzle together?
From a business
together?
Development perspective, sure. Because A, I have the most, like the time commitment in terms of the regular time commitment. I have those 2 days, so that's really helpful. It's also my background, you know, like coming from, like I'm coming from an industry where I'm like coming from marketing and sales. Like a lot of what my jobs have been is like, it, particularly from a marketing perspective, funnily enough, because it's like trying to like understand like, how do we conceptualize who we are and who do we align with? And I'm not really doing sales like the same way you would be doing if you had a product, even though I have done that in the past. I'm more doing collaborations and partnerships. It's a big part of marketing. So that's me. But like we're dipping in and out. Like I, you know, from a creative direction, like I can't do presentations. I don't have InDesign skills. So then people come in and do that. So we actually end up all sort of dividing the time equally. But in terms of that, biz dev, that's me. But I quite like it. I like meetings.
That hustle and that chase.
I kind of like it. So it kind of suits me. So stuff like that, like talking to talking to another institution, then talking to another programmer. So and then that idea of like, where do we get the money from? That's the big thing. But yeah, and then the route of sponsorship is always difficult because we don't want them to be involved with or have access to the research any more than the public would.
They should,
So that's always like a...
So it's kind of like a twofold. You're going after the opportunities, but then you're also having to figure out how you're going to fund them and have meetings with them.
I think the catch for a privately owned organization would be anything else that you'd be doing in terms of like marketing and events. Most companies these days do events as part of their marketing. Most companies want to align with social good. They want to show that they have a value. So we can provide that by saying, look, we're doing research and education into these issues. You can't necessarily inform the research, but you'll have access to it like the public would, but it's more about brand alignment. It's more about saying, yeah, we also care about these issues.
So the value proposition behind what you're offering is that research component of it and then that plan of how to execute it.
What the value to a sponsor is mostly about like engaging their community and brand alignment. Brand alignment with sort of like really a really cool arts and cultural event, but also brand alignment with a company that's doing great research in areas that they want to say to their customers, yeah, hey, we're contributing to society, we're contributing to the community. The value to programming and arts and cultural institutions is probably more around like the research, not that we'd sell them the research, but that they'd be interested in funding that kind of research because they're set up for the good of the community and things like that. So it's kind of different value propositions depending on who you're talking to.
Oh, I mean, it definitely sounds really exciting, and we'll definitely keep an eye out for that. I'm really excited to see what you guys get up to in the future. I'm really into what you're doing. I still can't get my head around that entire thing and the sauna thing, so I probably need to kind of look back at that and watch the videos, because I think
when you
were well into it.
Yeah, right? When you see it visually, like, you would totally get it.
Yeah, because that just sounds incredible. Turning an entire amphitheater into some sort of an experience where people ended up dancing on the water.
It looks incredible. Like it looks like a movement, like a human movement
it
style.
It was contact improvisation dancing. So it's a form of, it's performance art, but it's also kind of, it's kind of a cult. It's not, they're going to hate me that I said that. And like, they're really good friends of mine. But it's kind of like, it's kind of like yoga. It's therapy through movement and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then they do
yeah.
performance as well. So that was like us engaging with like a cultural or artistic performance.
Yeah.
But people that attended didn't dance on the water. I mean, they could dance on the water if they wanted to, but like that didn't really happen. But yeah, but you can see images online, and you can also read about that. Going back to that idea of what you're talking about like why do those kind of spaces drive connection? You can read about all the different things that we found out about that. In terms of like what you were talking about, selective, like talking and not talking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we named it, selective intimacy. So it's spaces that facilitate this idea of being able to talk or be alone, because a lot of people seek out spaces to just be alone but surrounded by other people.
Just the comfort of having the noise around them.
Yeah. We call it alone but together, but then other people are seeking out spaces to actually connect. So you need to create a space that allows both things to take place and neither one of those to be awkward or uncomfortable.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah. And anyways, you can read all about the results on the website. But yeah.
That sounds amazing. Just before we wrap up, did you want to give us your social... Your social plugins, your website for audience to have a look.
So our website is collectivefutures.com.au, and the Instagram is also Collective Futures, and the Facebook as well. So, but you can find everything on the website.
Awesome. So if anyone wants to get in touch with you, they just go through the website and put an inquiry of some sort.
Yeah. So my email is just hello, or our email is hello@collectivefutures.com.au.
Awesome.
So yeah, shoot us a line. We're always interested in collaborating, and we're also interested in, you know, keeping a large group of collaborators. So anyone else that's freelance and interested in working on any projects or anything like that, hit us up, because we're always looking.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, definitely.
I think Jewel the first Doves, two people is going to be us.
Even the Jewel of Doves workspace, like we've got plenty of people in there.
Yeah, no, for sure, yeah, because I think that's kind of we need to build up that kind of base of people that we can just go to, because it's so varied, the different projects that we're working on. It's kind of like, oh, we need to find someone to be able to do that.
That sounds really exciting.
That's exactly what we use it for. That's exactly what it's for.
Cool.
Any last words to kind of sign out with? Any advice to anyone who's kind of wanting to start something similar, or to start their own kind of design side hustle? Anything that springs to mind?
I think you just find out what you're really interested. For me, it's not something that I started because I wanted to start something. And if that's what you want to do, that's great as well. But it's kind of just start talking to people about what it is that you want to do. Mm. And then through that, you actually figure out what it is. So for me, it was just chatting and don't force it. You just start saying it out loud. And when you start saying things out loud about what you want and what you're interested in, it naturally just comes, and those opportunities come up, because you've sort of, even just saying it out loud just kind of brings it.
Definitely.
Yeah, totally. Just putting it into the universe.
Yeah.
Your words become things, kind of thing.
And people go, oh, I'm also interested in that. Or I know someone else who's interested in that. Mm. And it just kind of starts things. And I think you often don't say things because you like, oh, that's not me. Or, that was always a big thing for me. Like, even going back to the fashion thing, being like, oh, that I'm going to do a PhD in clinical psychology. I can't go and work in fashion.
Yeah.
Just saying it out loud meant that I ended up doing it, you know. So, yeah, I think that's important to just say what you're interested in.
Just on that note, because that's quite important. Sometimes I feel that people are too protective with their ideas and what they want to do. They want to keep it to themselves.
So we've had actually a few things being stolen. I don't know if you can say stolen, but we've submitted creative briefs, and that's always a problem in working in agency work and all that kind of stuff, you submit a brief and they want to know exactly what your creative idea is going to be, and then they say no, and then they take your creative idea.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, it really sucks. But also, you know what? Like, we've got more creative ideas.
Exactly.
And the way that they executed it, and it wouldn't have been the way that we executed it, and it looks like crap. So whatever, you know. Like, I mean, great if they go and do something amazing, and it stings a little bit, but. I also just think you know that you're on to something.
Definitely.
That's my...
When people are stealing your ideas, then you're definitely heading in that direction that you're
100%. Meant to be. 100%. I'm the opposite to that idea of being protectionist. It's not the way I work at all. I don't think you'd be like that if you started a collective. And you have to be open to things moving and shaping and different things. You have to be... Yeah, and it does suck when people... And also, like, you're working with friends as well, and so we've had conversations with people, you know, doing other projects that, you know, or going for the same project that you're going for. That happens with freelance world.
Yeah.
My philosophy is just, like, talk about it. But even I can be bad at that too. But I do think I think you have to say what you're interested in. I think you have to talk to people. I think you have to be open with it. I think you have to be passionate and curious, and you have to kind of put that out there. Because if you don't, you just don't get anywhere. Yeah, people steal ideas or do things, but it's just that's just kind of like the nature of kind of working in the creative industry, you know?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Definitely.
No, really, really well summed. Thank you again so much for joining us.
This has been great.
It's been mind blowing. Like, I still need to go and check out what you guys have done for the NGV,
because
I still can't comprehend.
Well, I can't wait to listen to this back. I normally listen to it straight after, and I feel like there's going to be so many gems that I've missed, because there's just so many facts
being thrown at us.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Friday evening to join us.
Oh, not at all, guys. It's been great. Thank you so much. I think what you're doing is great. So it's a really nice platform to be able to talk about your side hustle, because you don't often get the chance. So, yeah,
it's really cool. We appreciate it. We're glad you've had a good time with us.
I have. Been a rocking Friday night.
Awesome. Thank you.